History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. When we ask a few questions and take a little time to listen, we're always amazed by what comes back our way. And our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you're a longtime listener, I'm just going to go out on a limb and say there have probably been a couple of times over the years where you've heard an hour's worth of one of these veterans' life stories and you've said, boy, they need to write a book about this guy. I know I have, and every once in a while, that actually happens. Today, we get to hear about a brand new book like that from both the author and the subject. The book is called Earthquake, which happens to be the call sign of a World War II, Korean War, and Vietnam War veteran who began his military career as an enlisted man, but ended up with the rank of Brigadier General. You can find the book on Amazon, and of course I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. It's about the incredible life of Brigadier General Robert F. Titus, whose story we first heard on Hometown Heroes back in 2017 when he was just 90 years old. We're going to revisit some of that conversation today, also hear from the now 97-year-old Bob Titus, but we'll start with the author of this book, William B. Scott.
Last summer, late August 2023, I was approached by several guys associated with the Air Force Academy here in Colorado Springs about writing a book showcasing the life of Brigadier General Robert F. Bob Titus, call sign Earthquake. I was in the middle of another project at the time, but they arranged a meeting. We got along great. They pointed out, well, he obviously did too, that he was 96 years old, had this amazing story, which they outlined quickly to me. And it was clear that if we're going to capture this story, probably needed to jump on it right away. So I agreed to get started, did a few initial interviews with Bob. We hit it off pretty well. So away we went. I did 7 interviews with him over a period of a few months, went through all kinds of documents, you know, his officer effectiveness reports for his whole career, managed to write the book in about 3 months, turned the manuscript in December. It was very important to get this because his career was not only unique, but it was emblematic of what I would have to call an American hero.
Well, and you have some perspective on that yourself. I think I read in the back of the book that you've flown 81 different aircraft yourself.
I've logged time in 81 different aircraft. I was not a military pilot. I'm a civilian pilot, but I was a flight test engineer, which, you know, allowed me to get into quite a few different kinds of airplanes that we were testing. And then as a reporter for Aviation Week, Space Technology Magazine, one of my jobs was to go out, fly in various aircraft, and write stories about them. So that all added up to a long time in 81 different types of aircraft. It was an amazing career for me. It gave me a chance to look at quite a wide spectrum of different kinds of airplanes, and to really appreciate what General Titus had done.
Well, and that's where I was going with that, right? So you, when he talks about flying P-51s in Korea, or the jets that he flew in Vietnam, or conceptualizing, you know, the next generation fighter that would turn into the F-15, and all of that, you kind of have a feel for what he's talking about that the average lay person wouldn't.
Yeah, you're right, Paul. And to expand on that, when I found out that he and I were both graduates of the Air Force Test Pilot School, obviously separated by about 20 years, and hearing all his stories about flight testing aircraft during the golden age or the golden era of flight testing, when all the century fighters, the F-100, 101, et cetera, came into being, he flew them all. And having tested airplanes there at Edwards, obviously when I went through the test pilot school, as a flight test engineer, I have to make that clear, I was not a pilot. I could really appreciate the tremendous things that he accomplished as a test pilot, too. So I walked away from any number of interviews amazed. one man could accomplish all of this. I mean, he literally only bailed out of one airplane, and that was an F-51 that took some rounds, and he had to get out because the engine was going to quit. But then all of that time that he logged as a fighter pilot and as a test pilot and accomplishing unique things like, based on his own idea, flying an F-100 nonstop from England over the North Pole to Alaska, proving that single-engine fighters could be ferried from one side of the world to the other fairly quickly. So the guy just did so many things. I've always said he crammed several lifetimes into one.
We'll hear more from the author, Bill Scott, a little bit later. But for now, let's hear about some of those lifetimes crammed into one. Again, this new book is called Earthquake, and it captures some of the most impactful elements of a career that took Robert Titus from enlisted man in World War II to the rank of general, with decorations including the Air Force Cross, second only to the Medal of Honor. His interest in aviation began at a pretty young age.
My first flight in an airplane, I guess I was about 7 years of age, when my father took me out to visit an airfield locally in Hagerstown, Maryland, where I started the third grade. Moved there when I was 7 years old. There was a fellow with a Waklo, single-engine biplane, two open cockpits, and I sat in my father's lap in the back cockpit, and that was the experience. I thought it was a good idea. I remember walking past the post office on the way home from school, and there was a big poster out on a board in front saying, "Be a flying cadet." And there's a picture of airplanes over Randolph Field, Texas. I thought that seemed like a good idea. And, of course, I grew up reading G8 and his Battle Aces and Eddie Rickenbacker in the Flying Circus. But opportunities seemed distant, and I didn't dwell on that. In my recollections, I was aware of the fact that it would be a great thing to do to get up in airplanes. But it was sometime later that the opportunity came to me.
Well, I'm kind of struck by the irony here, because I think about all the pilots I've talked to over the years who chuckle at paratroopers and say they don't know why anyone would want to jump out of a perfectly good airplane. And you started out as a paratrooper, ended up as a legendary pilot. And if you would have listened to everybody else, I guess you would have been in the Navy, because you went to high school in a Navy town.
I did indeed. But I had no interest in being in the Navy, to tell you the truth. I actually enlisted in the chief petty officer, loaded up with gold braid, talked to me about how I was going to enjoy the Navy, and I told him I wasn't interested in the Navy, as I say. So he sent me off to infantry basic training, which was fine with me. They were looking for paratroopers, and actually I was a bit too tall. The limit was supposed to be 6 foot, and so I kind of scrooched down on the scale, and the sergeant was saying, "Oh, no, you got to stand up straight." And the captain said, "No, we'll take him." So I went through jump school, and I ended up in the 82nd Airborne Division. The war ended while I was in training. The 82nd had redeployed from Europe to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and I marched in the World War II Victory Parade, never having heard a shot fired or been overseas. And the 82nd was the World War II Victory Parade from Washington Square in New York all the way up to Central Park. Great event.
Well, those are some memories for you. Speaking of memories, how about December 7th, 1941? Were you in Norfolk that day?
I was. We were walking. I and a couple of my buddies were walking along and heard about it on the radio, I suppose. And we were talking about how we were going to beat the Japs and so on. We walked by an apartment building, and a woman opened a window and said, "You boys don't understand what war is all about. This is not interesting. This is not a good thing." And we were chagrined, I guess, by our immaturity. But, you know, we were fired up because, as all young men, think there's some glorious opportunity in a war. Little did we know.
Well, you have perspective on multiple wars now, but you mentioned marching in that victory parade, and that had to be quite a sight. I mean, to see the people lined up on the streets of New York, I can't imagine how unique that was. Was there some disappointment on your part that you didn't get to go overseas and be a part of it?
Well, I was looking forward to it. In fact, at Fort Bragg, we were lining up to, before I went, the 82nd came back, before the war ended, we were in advanced airborne training in the Alabama area of Fort Benning. They were forming up a new airborne division, presumably to jump into Japan. And I recall, again, on the radio, hearing about the atomic bombs going off, and figured, that's probably a better deal. I don't know that I would have enjoyed jumping into combat in Japan.
Well, Ed, you have perspective from what you did in Korea and Vietnam and time in the Pentagon and at the highest levels of our military. But when you look back on that, do you feel that the atomic bomb and President Truman's decision saved your life?
I can't say that I ever gave it any consideration. had the opportunity presented itself, I'd have been happy to go with the troopers, I suppose, and engage in combat and try to win the war. That's what we were being trained to do, and I don't think that very many of us were anxious to go or uninterested, but, you know, we'd have done what we were told to do.
Well, and I guess you didn't know at the time either that eventually you would have the chance to come down behind enemy lines and fight your way back across. Not that that's what your plan was.
No.
How did you go from 82nd Airborne to Air Force pilot?
Well, when I got out of the Army, I went to Virginia Tech to study engineering. I was ready to get out of there. I met an Air Force recruiter, and he said, we're looking for pilots. And they offered me an opportunity to go to pilot training. Okay, if I could pass the physical. I said, what's the deal? I said, well, we're looking for pilots. We'll put you into pilot training. If you make it, we'll keep you and give you a commission. And if you don't, we don't want you. And I thought, my goodness, this is a no-brainer for me. You're going to teach me to fly, and if I flunk out, I just go home. No charge, no commitment. I'll sign up. And that's what happened. I went through pilot training and was commissioned and got my wings. And shortly thereafter, they gave a war for me, as I saw it.
How did you receive that news of war?
I was in New York. I had flown up there in a P-51 Mustang to meet a girl that I knew. And the following Sunday, I was ready to leave town. And I was headed out to Floyd Bennett Field, where I'd parked the airplane. And I heard the news that the war started in Korea. And I was anxious to get involved. And I kept applying. It took me about a year before they finally, I was essential where I was, I was told. We were flying Mustangs and making blips for a radar controller school down at Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida. I kept going over to personnel saying, I want to sign up for an assignment in the war. Well, finally, a year or so later, I got orders to go to Luke Field and shoot a little gunnery and then head over to Korea. As it turned out, I got waylaid and sent to Japan for about 3 months. And again, I was still trying to get into the war in Korea, and I kept contacting friends of mine over there. And finally, a fellow by the name of Rock Brett, who was the ops officer of one of the fighter squadrons, went to his group commander, who in turn put in a name request for me. As a result of that, I got called in by the colonel, who my group commander, and told me that I was going out of channels, and that was totally unauthorized and unacceptable. He said, however, you've got the group gunnery records. Maybe you can do some good over there, so I'm going to let you go.
Why was that so important to you? Why did you so doggedly pursue that assignment?
I had in my blood the image of myself as a fighter pilot, and fighter pilots do what they do in war. And as I said, when I was a kid, I read lots of books, G8 and His Battle Aces and Eddie Rickenbacker, Fighting the Flying Circus, and I just felt that's where I should be. As long as there was a war and I was a pilot and I was a fighter pilot and what I considered to be a pretty good fighter pilot, I wanted to be involved. I thought that was my job.
And you have flown most of the fighter aircraft that the Air Force has had. Are you still kind of partial to that Mustang?
Oh, yeah. As I tell my good friend up in Denver, who's a tax attorney and owns a Mustang and races at Reno, he also owns a Sea Fury, and he asked me one time what I thought of the Mustang, and I told him, what else can you think of about it when you understand it's the best airplane that God ever allowed to be built? Yeah, it's a great airplane, and that and the Sabre jet are my favorite.
Well, and you flew them both in Korea, 101 combat missions in Korea. Do I have that number right?
So I understand. I didn't pay much attention, but they told me you already flew 100 and you got to go home.
What kind of missions were those? I mean, that's a lot. That's
flying the Mustangs, it was mostly ground support and interdiction, flying up the main supply routes, looking for trucks or anything coming down into the battle area to keep the supplies from the enemy getting to the front, and a lot of close air support. For the Army on the ground and the Marines dropping bombs and napalm and strafing to assist our comrades on the grounds. And a very noble mission. Close support is a very fine mission because you work so close to the troops, we used to say. The 40s and 50s will get you in the coolant, and then the day's over.
How did you handle that, the pressure and precision that those kind of missions required?
You know, you just get yourself, your teeth into it, as it were. You're so intent on providing the best support you can and keeping the enemy suppressed and their fire suppressed that you just get into it. It's like when you're playing football. You get into the game and you're just one with the environment. You just get yourself so heavily involved in it that you haven't got anything else better to do. You just want to do the best you possibly can.
Speaking of football, if you pick up this book, Earthquake, one of the quotes you'll find on the back jacket comes from perhaps the greatest Air Force Academy football player of all time, three-time Super Bowl champion Chad Hennings. He says, through my experiences as a fighter pilot and NFL Super Bowl champion, I have met a mere handful of individuals who I would consider to be leaders of men. General Bob Earthquake Titus is at the top of that list. As my mentor when I was a cadet at the Air Force Academy, Bob inspired me to be a warrior, both on the gridiron and ultimately as a fighter pilot flying A-10 Warthogs in combat. His commitment to duty, to his country, to his family, and to God will inspire generations of young men and women willing to stand tall in the gap between freedom and tyranny. Bob Titus is my hero. Again, you can find the book on Amazon, and it's linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, more from the author and the subject. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, where it's always fulfilling when we get to update a story we brought you years ago because there's a new development. In this case, it's the new book, Earthquake, by Bill Scott, capturing the inimitable career of Air Force legend Robert F. Titus. The author, Bill Scott, has had quite the career himself, a flight test engineer who graduated from the Air Force Test Pilot School, has spent time in 81 different aircraft, and has enjoyed an adventurous career writing about aviation that's included authoring or co-authoring 7 books.
I would guess that after all those years writing about aviation, experiencing so many different aircraft, being around the pilots and pioneers that you had to have met over all those years, that it's probably pretty tough to impress you. But it seems like in putting this book together, there are some things about Earthquake that impressed you.
Yeah, most definitely. As I worked with him through this whole process, obviously as a writer, you have to say, now, what's the theme that's going to tie all this together? It can't be just a series of incidents that by themselves are pretty impressive. But, you know, what's the singular theme, or how would you sum up this guy in one sentence? I came down to leadership by example, because he definitely was a prime example of exactly that. So I kind of focused on that, got him to tell me a few incidents that underscored that. So he, starting from his days as an enlisted guy in the Army, and you say, how did this one-star general with so many years of service, you mean to tell me he started as a GI at the end of World War II, having to do things like rake the dirt, hump a pack around, jump out of airplanes to get his paratrooper wings, and then to progress through everything he did? He learned along the way what good leadership was and what bad leadership was. And of course, he brought that, especially when he was a commander, and it made him a much better commander. And those were his words, I believe. He said, my enlisted time taught me a lot. And then working his way up through the ranks, I'd like to say that he was what I would call a stereotypical good leader. He didn't take any BS, but he really looked out for his people. And he always led from the front. You know, he led so many combat missions. You say, how did the guy survive all that? Well, number one, he was a darn good pilot. And number two, he always had the attitude that, well, if I don't make it, that's the way it goes. But duty, mission, leadership by example, those were the things that popped out for me, and I tried to weave them through the book.
One thing that comes through loud and clear is the fighter pilot's mentality that has long propelled Earthquake Titus.
You know, sometimes you get butterflies in your belly on the way to the target, but when you get to where you're, when you get into the hostile environment, again, you're so busy, you're so involved, you haven't got time to think about your own personal welfare. It's just not within the equation of your thought process.
And you had targets, but you were a target. How frequent was anti-aircraft fire from the ground, or maybe even enemy fighters?
Well, no enemy fighters when we were flying Mustangs down at the, they were too far away. There were some that had occasionally been involved with that activity before they stabilized the demilitarized zone, as it was when I was there. So there was no evidence or any indication of enemy aircraft activity, but there was an awful lot of ground fire. And I got hit quite a few times. Every time I bring the airplane home, the sergeant would be looking at it, and he looked at me and said, you got my airplane, a hole in my airplane again, sir. And say, sorry about that.
Did that ever get to you, the holes in the airplane, realizing how many there were or where they were and how close you came to being shot down?
Well, you know, I remember one incident where I felt the blast of some kind of a projectile, and the airplane bounced, and I smelled cordite, and I thought, I'm done. And I called my wingman and said, I'm hit, and I'm headed out. And I looked at all my instruments. Everything was fine. I thought, what in the world is this? I had some rockets on board, and I thought, well, I'm going back and shoot up that target again. And I did, but apparently there's no damage to the airplane. It's the strangest thing. Only experience I ever had like that. You know, it startled me.
Sure.
You know, trying to sort out what I was going to do. I wasn't terrified of anything, as I recall. When you get it and you have to bail out, then you do that too.
Did you ever have to do that in the 51?
Yeah. I got hit, and I didn't realize I was hit until the engine started heating up. The obviously, the coolant had leaked out, and it had gone and hit the peg, and the airplane started to burn, and I was forced to bail out. I just went out over the edge, and I was a lot lower than I thought I was, apparently, because I pulled the ripcord and the parachute opened and I hit the ground almost all at once. I didn't know where I was. Nobody else saw me bail out. They thought I was gone. When I got home, I didn't show up. Anyway, it turns out I was in the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, and I was between the enemy and the friendly forces in this no-man's zone. I tried to orient myself and looked up, and there were guys from the north coming toward me, guys in quilted pajamas, and I thought, they're not the right kind of guys for me. I had my 45, and I fired a couple shots, and then I heard a burp gun or two, and I thought, whoa, this is not too good. So I hunkered down in the hole, and then a short time later, I heard a voice that said, keep your head down and crawl this way. A good American voice. The Marines sent out a patrol, laid down suppressing covering fire, and I crawled over and ended up in a bunker and hitchhiked my way home.
Wow. So all these times that you've been there for the ground forces, now they're here for you.
Yeah, they saw me. The airplane crashed and the parachute opened when we hit the ground. They said, boy, that was close. You almost didn't make it. I said, well, almost is not good enough, is it?
Wow.
I got home. The main supply route where they delivered ordnance and supplies to the front lines ran right through my base, K-46. It wasn't very far south of there. And I got home and the guys already, I said, okay, who's got my shaving brush? They already divvied up my stuff.
Were you able to get it all back?
Yeah.
Did that experience change your perspective after that on future missions?
I can't say that had anything to do with it. I mean, I simply accept it. I've been accused all my life of having a very level personality. I never get too excited about anything. They gave me a ride in a T-33, two-seated trainer. That was my first time in a jet. When I landed from that, they said, okay, there's a Sabre jet. You can get in that and fly it. And we're going to give you 10 hours. If you can't cut it in that 10 hours, then we don't want you. And I think it was my fourth ride when I was flying number four in a flight of four. And we were flying north, and I remember flying over a river and looking down, and I said, that looks like it might be the river that we're not allowed to cross. But we did. Then suddenly we were going in the opposite direction. Leader turned south in a hurry, and I'm strung out number four. I said, I guess I'm checked out. It looks like we're in the combat area. Anyway, the airplane's in front of me, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I said, no, I'm 4. 3, 2, oh, that one out in front must be a MiG. But the lead had not made any radio call. It turned out that he had radio failure. And the MiG just zoomed up and turned north. And had I known he was going to do that, I think I'd have stayed high and tried to intercept him. But that was my first vision of a MiG and my first combat mission in F-86. And I had about 4 hours of flying time in it.
Yikes. And like you say, nothing really ever gets to you as you describe that. It's no big deal, but listening to it, it sounds like a really big deal. Could you feel the difference in power, in speed, and was that difficult to adjust to?
I'll just have to tell you that prior to that checkout, when I had been in Japan, the group commander sat down at our lunch table with us one day, and he said, I need some jet pilots for the 94 squadron, F-94 squadron. And one of the guys at the table said, I've got some jet time. And the colonel said, how much you got? He said, I got about 15 hours. He said, oh, okay, you can go to that. Next guy had something like 9 hours. Oh, yeah, you can go join that squadron. I said, I'd like to do it, too. You got any jet time? No, sir. Well, then I couldn't use you. I said, are you going to tell me, sir, that it's harder to fly a jet than it is a Mustang? Well, you have to understand, it's an entirely different concept. And I'm thinking, I don't understand. And I don't know how I'm going to learn to understand. If I can't fly the airplane until I get some jet time, how does that work? Will it work differently in combat? Uh-huh. There's the airplane, go fly it. So there was nothing to it. I thought they'd been lying to me. I landed that thing, and I said, this is a kiddie car. It's the easiest airplane I've ever flown.
And so you continued to fly those over there in combat till the end of the war?
Yeah, until I finished 100 missions, and then they sent me home.
Anything about those F-86 missions in Korea stand out?
I never got up airborne. There were any MiGs up other than that first mission. I never saw another MiG, and it seemed like they weren't flying the days I was up. Unfortunately, I was looking for them all over the place, but never had the opportunity to engage MiGs in Korea.
And here you had been in the World War II victory parade in New York City. The Korean War, there was no victory.
No, and it was a shorter war, of course. I recall after the Vietnam War, being in Washington, and somebody saying to me, look at this terrible Vietnam War memorial, 50,000 troops, and that terrible. And I said, well, it took 10 or 12 years to do that. Have you ever been over to Gettysburg? It's only about an hour's drive, and you can see what we did to one another in 3 days. So war's bad. But other than that, the war went on for another year. And when it ended, I was pleased. I thought it was a lousy war. But then I guess I feel that way about all wars.
Yeah. Well, does that mean that you enjoyed being a test pilot more than flying in combat?
Oh, I enjoyed flying tests, and I was fortunate to be able to get that kind of a job. I flew aircraft across the North Atlantic to NATO countries for a year or so before I got orders to go to the test pilot school. That was a feather in my hat. It was something that I was seriously interested in. It's referred to now as the golden days of flight test. We learned a lot that we didn't know anything about. We lost airplanes in the process. We learned about pitch-up. We learned about adverse yaw. We learned about what we shouldn't be doing with airplanes that were pretty iffy.
Do you have to be a little nuts to volunteer for that duty?
No, you just have to be fortunate enough to be able to do the academics and understand the processes. And if you have a little skill, you can stay alive.
Was that kind of exciting for you to do something that no one else had done before?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I thought we had the best job in the Air Force. We had 10 fighter pilots in flight tests. While I was there, we lost 15. People say, how do you lose 15 out of 10? So you keep getting new guys.
It's like those infantry units in World War II.
Pretty much.
So I know that you tested a lot of different jet aircraft, but I read that you had a zero-length launch test where an F-100 is rocketed from a truck bed by a 300,000-pound thrust booster attached to the fuselage.
Actually, it was 130,000 pounds of black propellant. Yeah. It was.
What does that feel like?
It's a 4G acceleration. When you pull the trigger, you're already in full military power, and you stroke the afterburner, and now you've got all the power that the airplane's capable of generating, but you're held in position by some shear bolts, which don't shear until that 130,000 rocket booster lights off. And that just shoves the airplane forward and runs it out to about 275 miles an hour in 4 seconds. So it presses you back against the seat pretty strongly, like an elephant stepped on your chest.
Yeah.
And then you're flying. The rocket drops off of its own accord. The airplane is flying. Yeah, it was a very interesting flight test program.
And are you conscious that whole time?
Oh, sure. You don't. Transverse G's are no problem at all. Not like pulling the G's, you drain all the blood out of your head and into your G suit.
You know about that, too.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
When the Vietnam War broke out, Was that something where, because of your combat experience in Korea, you were eager to get over there and fly combat missions?
I was eager to get over there, yes. It took me a while. I was at headquarters, Tactical Air Command at Langley Field, Virginia, and I was working for the Deputy for Operations, General Gordon Graham. One of the things that I was involved in was putting together an F-5, Northrop F-5 Freedom Fighter deployment over there to evaluate the F-5 in combat. And I was the project officer working for General Graham and putting that thing together. And the unit was sent over there temporary duty, presumably for 90 days, with a big evaluation team to gather all the data. It was decided at the end of that program to extend the unit's term, make it a permanent installation, fill it up with additional aircraft and more pilots. And I had a call from the personnel guys, and I went upstairs to their office, and he said, I thought you'd be up here in less than a minute. Look, here he is, and here's a job you might want to be the commander of that outfit. And I was just before making lieutenant colonel, and the lieutenant colonel's job is a squadron commander in those days. I went down and asked the general, and he said, no, wrong airplane. And I asked him to think about it, and I come back tomorrow. Remember, he said to me, well, you should be flying Phantoms. I said, I can do that later. He said, what will your wife say? I said, we won't tell her. So,
and you didn't?
And didn't tell her. But anyway, I got the job, and I was really looking forward to that. I've been asked many times, what's the best job in the Air Force? And I said, squadron commander of a fighter squadron in combat. So I was able to command the Scotia Tiger outfit, and then I extended it so I could fly Phantoms north.
Yeah. And you flew 400 combat missions in Vietnam?
Mm-hmm. 400 and some. I don't know how many, to tell you the truth. Some of them I didn't think were worth counting.
That's an eye-popping number.
I'd just the odds. If they'd let me.
I know you would. But just, I mean, when you step back and think about the odds, I mean, you've already survived over 100 missions in Korea, crazy stuff as a test pilot, 400 missions in Vietnam, taking your life into your hand every time.
Well, that's not my call.
You really did enjoy that work.
Yeah, it's a great job. It's the cutting edge of the sword. You're where it is. Serratius at the bridge. It's being there.
If you have 400 of them, there's no one that's typical. But can you give us a taste of what some of those missions were about or like?
Oh, my gosh. You know, it's hard to go back. And, of course, shooting down that first MiG-21 was a great experience. We were escorting some F-105s down what is called Thud Ridge. It's a mountain ridge that runs northwest to southeast right into Hanoi. We were airborne, and I saw a MiG, and I broke off and announced that I was engaging a MiG. He was in a descending turn to the left, and there was mountains in the background. And so the Sidewinders, which are a heat-seeking missile, were not valid at that date and time because of too much background radiation. So I hooked up with a radar homing missile. Now, that was an AIM-7 Sparrow missile, and you'd lock onto the target and transmit information to the missile, and the missile then would guide to the target. However, I fired the first missile, and it didn't guide. I never saw it, and my backseat is saying, fire another one. I fired another one, and it too didn't guide. And I thought I was going to have to ram this guy. But finally, the third missile hit him in the wing root, and he ejected. And I was amazed that he had what looked like a Martin Baker seat, an ejection seat. And I thought, oh, wow, he's got the same kind of a ejection seat system that we have. So I was kind of pumped on that.
Yeah, was that kind of a watershed moment for you? Here you'd been in combat in a P-51. You'd been in the F-86 and never had that experience of going toe-to-toe with an enemy fighter like that.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was a thrill because, again, I'd been wanting to shoot down airplanes since I was a kid.
Yeah, well, and there you did. But shooting down two in the same mission is bigger than shooting down one, and you received the Air Force Cross. The only thing higher that you could have gotten is the Medal of Honor. I mean, this is a prestigious, prestigious medal. May 22nd, 1967. It sounds like maybe that same route that you just talked about, huh?
Essentially, this time I was taking a flight of 8 in to provide cover, and we're heading east toward the target area, as I recall, probably about 16, 17,000 feet in position to look at the box of F-105s. And I don't recall, there were 12 or so of them, 3 flights of 4, as I recall. In any event, there were a couple of instances. I saw a flash out to the sunlight reflecting off other aircraft, obviously, out to my 1 o'clock position, and they went off to the right, and I followed them for a while. And I determined that they were no longer a threat to the strike force, so I was concerned about being in position over the flight, protecting the strike force, so I went back to where I should have been. And I called for a jettison of the external tanks because I'm figuring, okay, the MiGs are up and they're engaging. I looked over my shoulder and I saw 2 MiGs coming up our 6 o'clock position, and they were firing missiles. And I called for a break, went a hard left turn, and then as the MiGs went by, I reversed, and the one went up. I saw the one. I put my pipper on him in the gun sight and got a good growling tone from a Sidewinder missile and released the Sidewinder missile. And it flew right up his tailpipe. He exploded. And then I looked out, and here's another MiG at my 1 o'clock position. So I headed for him, and he then made a hard diving turn, and we went through a series of... This time I had a 61-millimeter gun pod, but I had no computing sight. All I had was a pipper. Anyway, when he finally had to roll out, I put my pipper in front of him and just pulled the trigger and hosed him down the center, and he conveniently crashed. So that was the second one. That's how it was.
That's how it was. Well, here's what the Air Force said about it. They said, the President of the United States of America takes pleasure in presenting the Air Force Cross to Lieutenant Colonel Robert F. Titus for extraordinary heroism in military operations against an opposing armed force as an F-4C mission commander in the 389th Tactical Fighter Squadron, 366th Tactical Fighter Wing, Da Nang Air Base, Vietnam, in action near Hanoi, North Vietnam, on 22 May 1967. On that date, Colonel Titus led his flight into one of the most heavily defended areas of North Vietnam in direct support of F-105 strike aircraft operations. Undaunted by accurate flak and five surface-to-air missiles that were launched at his aircraft, he repeatedly and unhesitatingly engaged numerous MiG-21s in defense of the friendly aircraft. During these aggressive and courageous aerial encounters, Colonel Titus destroyed two MiG-21 aircraft. As a direct result of his tenacity and extreme bravery in the face of great danger, the F-105 force was able to accomplish its assigned mission. Through his extraordinary heroism, superb airmanship, and aggressiveness in the face of hostile forces, Lieutenant Colonel Titus reflected the highest credit upon himself and the United States Air Force. How's that sound?
Sounds a little inflated, don't you think?
Well, you tell me. You didn't say anything about the five surface-to-air missiles launched at your plane.
Well, I was vaguely aware of their presence, but I couldn't concern myself with them. I was occupied with the enemy fighter.
How close do you think they came to you?
I have no idea. There was a lot of flak, I know that. But, again, I was not interested in the flak. My wingman said later, he said, all I can think is I'm watching my squadron commander get shot down. But, you know, my job was to get the MiG.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't he saying that because that was probably the likely outcome of the situation you found yourself in?
It's probably close.
And it would have been probably not just you shot down, but some of those F-105 shot down.
Could have been.
So that incident, you're awarded the Air Force Cross for. Do you take some pride in that? Was it a proud moment when they pinned it on you?
You know, the only thing I can say about combat decorations is that, as I told somebody earlier some years ago, they decorate you for things that you don't think are particularly significant, and the things that you thought were really spectacular that you accomplished, no one noticed.
And you know what I'm going to say, don't you? If you want to find out what some of those achievements are, you ought to pick up the new book, Earthquake, Capturing the Exemplary Career of General Robert F. Titus. We have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and when we come back, some final thoughts from the author, Bill Scott, as well as the general's perspective on the book and the chance he had to sign copies of it for the entire graduating class at the Air Force Academy. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-533-3328.
honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a chance to tell you about a new book that showcases one of the most accomplished veterans we've met here on the program over the years, retired Air Force General Robert F. Titus, call sign Earthquake. If you want to learn how he acquired that call sign, you can read it in the book by that title, Earthquake. Before we hear General Titus's thoughts on the book, let's hear a little more about the general from the book's author, Bill Scott.
You know, the guy never quits. In his 90s, he took voice lessons because he did have a good singing voice, but he always wants to make it better. So he and his current wife took singing lessons, and they routinely sing in church. He has to be on oxygen full-time now, but he still gets out and does things. When I saw him last week, he was still pretty chipper. Let me tell you one little example in recent times that I think epitomizes what he is today. On April 25th, we had a heritage moment at the Air Force Academy. Thanks to some donors, we gave away 1,025 copies of this book, Earthquake, to the graduating cadets at the academy. So as part of the heritage moment that honored him, General Titus, another retired general, Jack Catton Jr., Major General, served as a master of ceremonies, and they had Earthquake and me sitting on stage in Arnold Hall. Each of those seniors, as they walked in, got a copy of this book. I introduced Earthquake, and then he regaled the cadets a bit about duty, honor, mission, leadership by example. And then Jack Catton said, would you please tell the cadets about shooting down a MiG? And he just kind of bellowed, Earthquake did. Well, when I got to that first one, I yelled, I got that blankety blank. And the whole cadet wing, or the seniors, just roared in approval. It was a fine moment for Earthquake, I'll tell you. Thereafter, we went down to a table and we signed books for over 2 hours for cadets that stood in line at least that long to get him to sign their books. And again, the leadership was there. He asked every one of those cadets what their name was and then personalized the book to that cadet as he signed his name, handed the book to me, and I signed it. Somewhere along the line, his portable oxygen system got turned off. Nobody noticed it, but he was hurting by the end of the time that we, you know, concluded everything. Nobody knew the oxygen was off, but he needs to be on it 100% of the time. And even though his oxygen level was dropping to who knows, 80%, which is dangerous, he just kept pressing on signing books. Here he is, 97 years old, got to finish the mission, right? That's Bob Earthquake Titus. He's one of these guys that you just never heard much about over the years. Yeah, we all heard him robbing Olds, right? He was a legend, but Earthquake was right there with him. And, of course, the two guys knew each other. They were friends, but they were such, you know, strong personalities that they clashed, too. So when I did interviews with roughly 18, 20 people that knew him, his family, et cetera, I heard some great stories along the way about not only Robin Olds, but many of the legendary fighter pilots and test pilots that he had known and worked with over the years. The people that I did interview couldn't say enough great things about him. I would like to say that even his family, to a degree, stands in awe of this man.
Well, and if people pick up the book, I'm sure they're going to feel the same way. And General Olds' book has picked up quite a bit of notoriety. I hope that this one will as well. Earthquake, about Brigadier General Robert F. Titus, fighter pilot, test pilot, leader. Bill Scott is the author. Bill, thank you for taking us inside the project a little bit, sharing some of your personal perspective on General Titus. As far as people who may be ordering this book for a gift for someone in their life or just curious and want to read it, I've read the blurbs on the back and I've seen all those credentials from people like Chad Hennings, one of the mentees that General Titus has poured into over the years, and General McInerney, Mike Gould, who was the superintendent at the academy. There's some great reviews of the book. But for you personally, is there a number one reason that you would say somebody should pick this up and read it?
Yes, I think there is, because people today look to the wrong figures, if you will, for heroes, young people in particular. Taylor Swift, my God, everybody considers her, you know, this remarkable person. Athletes, politicians, certain ones. People tend to look up to these, that maybe they turn them into heroes in their mind. But it felt like Bob Titus, kind of flying under the radar a good bit of his life, except for those around him, really epitomizes what we Americans need to think of as heroes. And I know you, Paul, have profiled any number of people that qualify as well. But Bob Titus might have just slipped off the radar if we hadn't written this book. And if I may, just in closing this, read the last paragraph of a review that's going to be in the Society of Experimental Test Pilots Journal, Cockpit, they call it, that'll come out next month. And this guy's a Brit, also a test pilot. But he said, is Earthquake a good read? Well, let's put it this way. If you were to take a copy along on an overnight transatlantic flight from the U.S. to Europe with the idea of reading a few pages before nodding off, you might just find yourself flipping the last page as the landing gear coming down for landing and not for a moment regretting the lost sleep. An extremely long sentence, but I think it captures the essence of why I think a lot of people will enjoy this book.
A compelling review indeed. But how about General Titus's review of this new book that details some of his remarkable life's journey? You heard Bill Scott reference the supplemental oxygen now required to project that booming baritone, and you may hear that oxygen a little in the background, but you're also going to hear the same passion and certainly the same love of country in this 97-year-old patriot that we heard when he first joined us on Hometown Heroes at age 90. And you'll also hear a still confident yet humble hero who always poo-pooed the idea of somebody writing a book about him.
Well, it germinated over a period of years, I guess, the best way to describe it. I was asked by many people for many years, oh, you've got to write your autobiography. And I said, no, I'm not into that. I don't feel like I want to do that. In fact, I won't do that. Ultimately, Leon Delisle, whom you know, ran into Bill Scott. Anyway, we got together, and I reluctantly agreed to sit down with him to see if whether or not we had a match, whether we could communicate or whatever. I don't know. We wanted to get to know one another. And one thing led to another, and he came and sat in that chair for I don't know how many hours, made many visits, and he'd record, and then he'd come back with a draft and ask me to correct anything, any fix any disparities. And so that's how it went, and finally he got a book published.
And why were you so reluctant with this project?
I just don't see, it's not me to, I have a resistance to tooting my own horn. I think that I did what I was supposed to do. I don't need any accolades from anybody, and I'm not comfortable with accolades. I just didn't see any point in writing a book.
Now that it's complete and you've held it in your hand and read it, how do you feel about it?
Well, I probably added a lot of different stuff that is not there, but a lot of people have read it. They're happy with what they read, and they pass a lot of compliments to Bill about the book, and they, again, give me a pat on the back, too. So I guess Bill's accomplished what he chose to, and I have no regrets.
And I know that for years, you mentored countless cadets at the Air Force Academy here, and there's some memories of that around your office, even a football team from the WAC champion 1985 Falcons who went 12-1 with your buddy Chad Hennings, who also wrote a nice blurb on the back jacket of this book. But you got to go back to the Academy and sign books for the whole senior class and had a chance to address those young men and women and interact with them. Something tells me that was a memorable day for you.
It was an interesting day. I wasn't quite sure what it was going to be all about, other than Bill and I would be on the stage, and the firsties were coming in to do whatever they were supposed to do. It was a mandatory meeting for them, but a sizable contingent arrived, and at the appropriate time, they played a video of the F-15, and then Bill took the mic and proceeded to talk about what he felt like talking about. I don't even remember what he talked about, to tell you the truth. And then I was told it was my turn to talk. So I talked to the cadets, and don't ask me what I talked about, because I didn't have any notes. I just spoke off the top of my head. I talked about character development and responsibility and leadership and that sort of thing. And seemed to go over well. Okay. Then there was an opportunity for some of the cadets to ask some questions. The acoustics were terrible. I could not hear the questions. So there was a general standing at the podium, and he was able to translate the questions, and I did my best to answer them. One question which amused me was, when you shot down one of those MiGs, how did you feel about it? I don't know if he thought I was remorseful or what. I said, well, it was simple for me. I just punched the mic button and said, wahoo, I got that son of a... That's got a positive reaction from the cadets. It may have provided some chagrin on the part of the senior officers there. I don't know.
Well, that's what I've appreciated about you, and the opportunities I've had to interact with you is everything out of your mouth is genuine and sincere and authentic. And what I infer from the book, what's contained in it, and your approach to it, is that as reluctant as you were, you hope that if the pilots and leaders of the future read this, there's something that they can use to chart their own course that can have a positive impact on their future. Is there a piece of advice or a principle that, from your view, is paramount?
Very simple, and it's in the book. Duty is the most sublime word in the English language. No one can do more. No one should ever expect to do less. So that was my guiding principle, that and the support of my guardian angel.
Is there anything else you want to say about the book or anything else in general?
Well, to follow up on your previous remark, there are numbers of people who said to me, well, it's important. The book is important for the purpose that you suggested, to set an example for those who are coming up through the system. Officers who are now being commissioned are going to have increasing responsibility, accept that responsibility, and perform in the best interest of the nation and in the service. That's what they're sworn to do, and that's what they should do, and that's what's expected of them. And to the extent they do that, we're a much better blessed nation. God bless the United States of America. May we recover from this tragedy that we're now encountering in bad leadership.
The one and only Earthquake, General Robert F. Titus. If you want to pick up the new book, Earthquake, for yourself or for a friend, search for it on Amazon or just click on the link at hometownheroesradio.com. That's all the time we have today, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.